You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here. LastWordOnSports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, LastWordOnSoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, Last Word Radio, Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scarves. For your great custom scarf options, or for any MLS, USL, or US Soccer scarves, head on over to RoughneckScarves.com. We are coming to you on the evening of Wednesday, October 16th, 2019. The MLS Cup playoffs and the NWSL playoffs are this upcoming weekend, but first, my trusty co-host Rachel McCrigger, we have some ranting to do about the United States men's national team, who less than 24 hours ago lost for the first time in both of our lifetimes to Canada.
Oh, Canada, for the first time since 1984. You know, we have only one thing to blame this on, and that is team chaos.
No, I definitely agree with you, Rach. Like, this game was absolute chaos. But, I mean, I guess, you know, we both had some thoughts on this. But in short, friends, for those of you who did not watch the game or weren't paying much, like, this was a Stu Holden had a really great video that he put up on YouTube. I would say, in terms of just the quality of the performance given the circumstances and everything, Rachel, that game last night is probably the lowest I felt about an individual game since the Cuba disaster, you know, 2 years and 6 days ago that ultimately eliminated the United States from qualification from the 2018 World Cup. You know, okay, there were a bunch of friendlies and there was a rotated squad and it was Dave Sarakin for almost a full calendar year, and then it was Greg Berhalter, and there were, again, there was rotations, and we saw some inconsistencies in the Gold Cup and everything, but that was still establishing ideas. And then I think really where, you know, this thing kind of triggers for me from the standpoint of, you know, if it happens once, then it's possibly a fluke, or at the very least it's a, you know, it's a single data point. It could be noise. If it happens twice, that's a coincidence and is worth at least some level a cause to pause. And if it happens three times, then okay, it's actual results. It's something systematic. There's something wrong with that. And I think at least the sentiment that I had and I saw a lot on Twitter was just the over the course of the 90 minutes against Canada, I saw no coherent plan for how to disorganize the opponent, Canada, in terms of trying to create chances and adjusting to what they were doing. And I saw no plan to adjust and try and disrupt what they were doing offensively to prevent them from getting quality chances. So, you know, okay, the Gold Cup, Greg Berhalter was trying to implement his style, and maybe the exercise of having them do that under the specter of a competitive situation was a worthwhile exercise. And okay, that game against Mexico was a back and forth game, and it was a rivalry game, and it was a final, and Jozy Altidore missed two sitters, and, you know, Jonathan Dos Santos had one spectacular finish, and that ended up being the result. It's like, okay, this was still with a work in progress standpoint from where the system was. It was still a work in progress standpoint in terms of the players that he wanted in, and you could argue that performance-wise, there were still a lot of quality opportunities, and that game could have gone either way. Might not be happy with the result, but I can understand that. Then you get to the last international window where it was playing out of the back with Zach Steffen in goal and everything that they had against Mexico and getting absolutely embarrassed 3-0 or 4-0. I don't even remember what the scoreline was. And it was build out of the back and do what you're trying to do at all costs, even when Mexico clearly had that figured out in the first 15 minutes in the game. And I thought, okay, maybe on some level, Berhalter's thinking that the U.S. struggling with that, but then figuring out how to work it when the opponent clearly has a path to disrupt the immediate plan A, maybe that was in some way a exercise. Maybe in some way he thought that was value, or at least that there was a lesson learned from what the players were doing and lessons learned from what he was doing. But then you know, let's throw out the Cuba game because it was 7-0 and it was completely inferior oppositions, and Cuba has a whole bunch of lot of things going on with their federation, let alone the entire country, that make them not a conducive, competitive national team at the international level. But then you go up against Canada, it's obvious in the first 15 minutes which team really cares, which one's actually emotionally invested, which one has a game plan for both the attacking side and the defending side of things. You know, one team was clearly overrunning the other, and at no point was there an actual plan to switch or anything. It seems like Greg Berhalter has an idea of what he wants to do. It's the exact same thing that he had planned, with the crew and with other club positions that he had with the national team, and it was plan A, and there's no clear defined plan B, let alone an attempt to even try something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it just wasn't good. Just downright plain and simple, it wasn't good. And I have 3 points that I wanna list when it comes to the national team. First, when it comes to the U.S. men's national team, I'm going to repeat something that was said 2 years ago, almost on the dot, as you said, 2 years, 6 days ago. What are we doing? And also, U.S. soccer is not prepared. Although I want to change that to U.S. soccer is not prepared when it comes to just this team. U.S. soccer seems like over the last 2 or 3 years, they don't know how to run a national team program for the men. I don't believe that Jurgen Klinsmann should have ever been fired completely. If it were up to me, he'd still be coach or at least have a technical director position. But here's one of the major issues right now, and yes, this is still my first point. We keep going back to the same old, same old. When Klinsmann was fired, U.S. soccer ran right back to Bruce Arena, and obviously that didn't work. Now, Greg Berhalter's brother is basically running the show, and essentially he gets hired. It's back to the same old familiar faces. And that brings me to my second point. You know, I'm sorry to the Columbus Crew fans out there. It's a great city, and the Crew, I'm glad it's staying there. But Berhalter's not a national team coach. He's not a national team coach for U.S. soccer. He's not a national team coach for Canada, Trinidad, Russia, Spain, whoever. However, he had a win percentage of less than 40% in both Sweden and in Columbus. And yet this guy was praised as the next big thing for U.S. soccer. But he's not, and he's not delivering. We're getting mediocre performances, and we're getting sorry excuses. It's like we're just getting no passion whatsoever for U.S. men's soccer and the program, and it's just getting absolutely walked over. And so for my third point, we need to stop relying on some of these mediocre MLS players. Your best talent is in Europe. I get it. For us, we're an MLS website and an American soccer website, but American soccer is growing. But still, your best competition, training, and matches are happening in Europe. Bringing guys consistently into the fold like John Brooks, Tyler Boyd, and heck, even a healthy performing Fabian Johnson and Bobby Wood would be better than what we have right now. These guys like Corey, Nick Lima, Will Trapp especially, and Christian Roldan, and keep in mind that's coming from a Sounders fan, and to me, Paul Areola, they shouldn't be there. To me, they haven't done much to be there, and I'm sick and tired of Berhalter playing it safe with his roster and trying to please U.S. soccer with these ridiculous MLS choices. We need to start sending these guys to Europe if we want to call them in. I'm pretty outraged that there's more MLS guys on the roster than European guys in most instances. You know, I've said it before and I'll say it 1,000 more times. The U.S. Soccer Federation should have never fired Jurgen Klinsmann.
I don't know that I'd go that far. Like, Jurgen still didn't have a whole lot of tactical ideas. That said, I don't know that. So if the approach was Jurgen didn't have a clear tactical identity and there was a lack of communication that was festering in a negative way in the locker room, that doesn't necessarily mean that Berhalter coming in with the communication that he has and the plan that he has been better. I don't know that no plan or just fitting things to the immediate situation you have at hand is any better or worse depending on the context to having one plan if that plan most of the time is bad against comparable opposition and generally works just well enough against weaker opposition. But I'm not really sure where the national team goes from this standpoint, and I guess not I'm not trying to coddle or be an apologist for Berhalter, Rachel, or any of the listeners, but I think a lot of this outrage is still on some level based or founded in PTSD for the team missing out on the 2018 World Cup. And the reality is that Berhalter could be undefeated right now. He could have won the last game, you know, the game against Canada 7-0, just like they did against Cuba. They could have won the Gold Cup and the recent friendly against Mexico, and nothing that they were going to do from Berhalter getting hired or even from Dave Sarakin taking over as the interim manager was going to undo what happened 2 years and 6 days ago in Trinidad and Tobago. And I think a lot of the outrage culture, while the criticism has been fair, has been coming or festering from some of that point. And so in that, I think Berhalter was given a very, very tall task, because it's not just even results-based at this point, Rachel. It's he had to heal wounds that he had nothing to do with, and he also had to get people to care and be engaged again, given how disengaging it was pretty much the entirety of the, I would say, you know, the events of 2 years and 6 days ago, in addition to the immediate, you know, the following 12 months that completely preceded that. Now, obviously, he's failing in terms of his immediate job, which is to get results with the national team, but I think where I'm starting to question things is I can understand a German national team coach coming in together and saying that we are going to gegenpress. I can understand, you know, a Spanish coach or the coach of the Brazilian national team adopting the style that is specific to the domestic league or to the players in terms of what they've grown up on. But the United States, at least from a soccer nation at the domestic level, the only thing we've ever really been elite at the international level has been putting numbers behind the ball, counterattacking, and set pieces, which is not the priority that Berhalter's doing. To be fair, I don't think that's the approach that is going to work if the national team ever wants to get to a World Cup semifinal, let alone to a final, let alone winning it like the women have done four times now. So in that, change has to happen on some level, but I'm wondering whether or not his style, or at least like some interim approach to building towards that, would have been maybe a little bit more effective, given that he's trying to adopt something that maybe Tyler Adams or Weston McKennie are used to now, playing in the Bundesliga. Maybe that some of the crew players that he's brought in would be familiar with, but maybe not anybody else in MLS or players playing in other very different leagues from a tactical standpoint in Europe would be familiar with. And that's a big shocking change compared to a German player born in Germany, grows up in the, you know, the Bayern Munich, you know, academy system, plays for Bayern Munich for 10 years, like a Bastian Schweinsteiger, and then goes to the German national team where it's a former Bayern Munich guy playing a style that Germany as a whole is used to. And I don't know that there's, you know, if we want to get away from the U.S. national team counterattacking and set pieces, being defensive and gritty and outworking the opponent in order to be better on the international stage, I don't know that Berhalter's system or Berhalter's clear plan A is the right approach for that immediate. Like, this is still a shock adjustment in the learning curve, and I think the fact that we did not see any adjustments from the national team, I'm just wondering if Berhalter is completely inflexible in terms of his approach, and he would rather go down dying with this approach than stray away from it, which, to be fair, were some of the criticisms that he got from his time in Columbus Crew. And so whether it's a shifting up of the players that he has, not having some of the favorites that he has from an MLS standpoint, calling in more of the Europeans, or actually trying to find some median between the talent and the players and what they are able to do on the field and what his system is, and how those two things are far apart, meeting somewhere in the middle, and the fact that we didn't see anything from that, in that I feel that this is the lowest that I felt since missing out on the World Cup. But I mean, if we're still going to be doing this, like, the team has to have somewhat of a coherent idea that isn't get the ball to Christian Pulisic and hope that Jozy Altidore's hamstring is okay, or that the system doesn't have to overcome the shortcomings of a young and inexperienced Josh Sargent or Giassi Zardes playing up top in order for you to get a result against Honduras in a year when you're going to be playing in World Cup qualifying. Am I crazy, Rachel?
You're not crazy, but my qualms with him are pretty much built within his roster. Like, if you're just calling the same old, same old, same old, and these guys aren't winning, you need to change it up. You can't keep calling these mediocre MLS players in who aren't doing anything to help the program.
No, well said. This is definitely, it's a multifaceted problem. It's not like, it's not one distinct thing where, you know, maybe you could say, like, it's not like everybody's just piling. I mean, yes, people are piling on the forward situation, you know, with Jossie's artist continuing to get called up and, you know, have a very low ceiling. And I would say maybe a moderately high, no, a very low floor, a moderately higher ceiling than Josh Sargent. But it's not like, it's not like everybody's coming in and saying that, like, we just need one of the forwards to end up working out, we're going to be okay. Or it's not, you know, it's not singularly a goalkeeping issue, for example. You know, it's a multifaceted problem, and a lot of it centers around Berhalter and the situation that he's been on. But if I were to put, you know, the blame pie, it's not singularly, you know, Jozy Altidore needed to be healthy for this one, or Tyler Adams needed to be healthy, or it's a goalkeeper thing. There are a bunch of personnel issues that are going on. There are a bunch of tactical issues that are going on, and those two things are inherently interwoven. And in that, it's almost kind of actually worse, because you can say that there's problems all over the place, you know, I guess maybe say for Weston McKennie being a bulldog in the situation and Paul Areola bringing energy, you know, off the field. But there's still just, there's just a bunch of issues that are going on with this. They all center around Berhalter, and I have to hope that he's at least somewhat self-aware enough to realize some of them and make somewhat of a change. Because if he's looking at all of those and thinking that all, okay, it's all okay, or it's just we need a little bit more time, or, you know, the, you know, this international window didn't allow me to call in some of the international players that, you know, the European based players that I wanted, like, there's not one single thing that's automatically kind of come in. Like, this isn't Cristiano Ronaldo going down with an injury and missing a camp for Portugal, and it's like, okay, everything will be fine when Cristiano's back. Like, I think Jozy impacts the result that we saw from last night, but I don't think Jozy single-handedly is going to save this team from all the problems that we clearly knew that were present during the Gold Cup when Jozy was on the roster, and are going to be present for, you know, the rest of World Cup qualifying and anything beyond. Never mind the fact that Jozy, again, is still kind of questionable for going into the playoffs. Injuries have been a problem for him, as it goes to, other than Josh Sargent, there's no obvious attacking piece you can call in and feel any confidence about in terms of their international prowess. And Qatar, assuming that the U.S. are able to get there, is still 3 years away. Okay, let's get away from national team stuff, Rachel, and talk about something equally chaotic but actually fun and good. And I'm, of course, referring to, dear listeners, the MLS Cup playoffs, which will be kicking off this coming weekend. We have four games for the first round on this coming Saturday, October the 19th, and then two games on the 20th. We will start in chronological order with the game taking place on Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Univision. And that, Rachel, is Atlanta United hosting New England Revolution, the 2 seed against the 7 seed. These two teams played back on decision day. Not a lot to fight for either of them, as New England had already clinched the playoffs and Atlanta knew roughly that they were already going to be hosting a home game. But Jose Martinez gets back in with the squad, he scores the goal, they play relatively well. I think if nothing else, that game was a good learning experience for Bruce Arena, which would have been the first game that he would have coached at Mercedes-Benz Stadium, and also being a little bit more, familiar with what's going on with that team, to where maybe he saw some things that he experimented with on decision day, and now he's going to be a little bit prepared at this point. But I feel like at this point, Rachel, that New England Revolution are playing with house money. Just them getting to the playoffs was fine, and they are massively outmatched from a talent standpoint, and I'm not sure how much Bruce Arena pragmatism is going to save them in this game.
Well, getting away from the national team is always great, but I feel like with Bruce Arena, we're dragged right back in. You know, I think he is a wonderful coach and has done really great things, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I'm not a fan of his personally, but I think just Atlanta is too good right now. They're too much on a high right now to get breezed by Arena and the Revolution. And I think you have to be confident if you're Atlanta with how Joseph Martinez has been doing, because he started out really slow in March and April, kind of had a bump in May, slowed down a little bit in June, and then July, August, September have been fantastic for him in terms of scoring goals, and 27 goals, 7 assists this, 27 goals this year, 5 of them are on PKs. You know, if he's taking a PK, it's not going to be an easy one to save. I don't think this match is going to go to penalties, but I think it's just going to be If anything, I think New England's going to play a little more defensive and kind of in a system where, okay, if you got the counter, go for it. But other than that, stay back a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Carlos Hill and Gustavo Bo are definitely used to the league at this point. And obviously, they've played against Atlanta. And, you know, it would be two games now for Carlos Hill and then just one, I think, probably for Gustavo Bo. But I mean, you know, I think Bruce Arena, you know, this is obviously a specialty in terms of flipping the switch or getting teams ready for, you know, individual playoff games that are relevant, especially now that he's more familiar with the roster. I still don't have a whole lot of faith in Frank DeBoer or this team to ultimately go on and make an MLS Cup or win it. You know, I definitely would pick them. I definitely would pick them to lose in a game at New York City FC, regardless of which baseball stadium that game's being played at. So, you know, but just based on talent alone, like, I feel like Atlanta United could roll up on the day on Saturday and the plan could just be get it to Dos Martinez and he could single-handedly win that game 2-1. There is going to have to be something that New England has up their sleeve from a systematic standpoint to take him out of the game, to force other lesser quality players to beat them, and they have to have a better plan from an attacking standpoint in order to try and undo Atlanta. I will say that maybe the one thing in doubt in this game that New England could be hoping for is Miles Robinson, who had to pull out of the U.S. national team camp. He got an injury on decision day, or it might have been a couple weeks earlier. I think it was a hamstring, you know, and so if he's not available, then I think Atlanta's a little bit more weak on the defensive front. But I think if I were to roll this game out and they were to play 10 times, like, I think 8 times out of 10, Joseph Martinez could single-handedly win this game for Atlanta, and I feel less confident in New England Revolution's ability to systematically shut him down and for a guy like Carlos Hill or Gustavo Bo to win the game from an offensive standpoint against a even weakened Atlanta United defense. So I guess on that note, Rachel, pick-ems here. Do either of us see any result that isn't an Atlanta win within 90 minutes?
No, I think Atlanta's going to win 3-1.
Alrighty, let's move on to the afternoon games then. This will be Seattle Sounders hosting FC Dallas. This will be at 3:30 p.m. Eastern on Saturday, and this will be on FS1. You are our resident Sounders girl, Rachel, so I'll throw it to you. What do you see in this match, and what do you see in Rave Green?
Well, I think I see a lot of really good in the attacking and in the midfield, and I think on defense you're kind of in a question mark when it comes to who's gonna start alongside Kim Keehee. It's, you know, right now I think you have to go with the hot hand that is Ramon Torres. I think that Xavier Arriaga has gotten too many names written down on the discipline report. I think that when it comes to the playoffs, you kind of have to go with experience more. And, you know, and that's not really knocking Arriaga. You know, the same thing happened with Kim last year. You have a guy who comes in, doesn't speak the language, still learning how to communicate, still learning the system. And I think right now you just have to go with the experience and somebody who's been in the system longer. I think their backs are really great. I think Kelvin Leardom is probably having a career year. And, you know, he's been one to surprise us before. I mean, he scored, I believe, 4 or 5 goals this year and a couple game winners. So I think if there's anyone to really look out for in like a dark horse type of way, I think it'd be Kelvin Leardom because he's so good running up and down the flank, as is Brad Smith on the other side. And, you know, there is depth for the Sounders for sure. They got Luis Silva this past international window, and I think that their bench is good enough to help them if they get stuck. But you know, I mean, obviously, I think defense is a bit of a question mark for them. They just have to hope that everyone is on their A game, and you know, I'm excited to see who the center back pairing is going to be.
Well said on that front, Rachel. You know, I'll take maybe an FC Dallas focus on this point. CenturyLink Field has been a house of horrors for FC Dallas, whether it's been first legs of playoff games or just individual games. You know, they got that 1-1, that 0-0 draw a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, that was made, you know, one of the ugliest road draws that I've probably seen in my time watching FC Dallas. I guess where I come down in terms of my concerns about this team or just wondering what's going on with them is they had a really, really bad end of the season. Yeah, they absolutely blew out Sporting Kansas City to clinch their playoff playoff spot on decision day, but what version of Kansas City were they seeing versus the FC, the Colorado Rapids team that was fighting for their playoff lives, or New York City FC that was able to get a road draw when they were still planning for playoff seeding and everything. So, okay, FC Dallas got a really big win against a bad team that rotated the lineup, and Peter Vermees openly admitted that it was an abhorrent performance after the match, vis-a-vis what are they going to get against a team of quality in a road game when FC Dallas is one of the worst road teams to qualify for the playoffs. So, I mean, you mentioned some of the issues that that Seattle has going on defensively, but I guess I'm just wondering who could take advantage of that from an offensive standpoint. So, okay, so if you get the ball to Andrasik, then that's going to be key, but as long as everybody else in Seattle is able to cut out his service, like Michael Barrios is going to be really, really fast, but is it going to be able to do a whole lot on the ball, especially given that, yeah, Michael Barrios is fast compared to, say, a wide player for the Colorado Rapids in defense, but Rachel, I'm not sure that Michael Barrios is much faster on the ball than a Kevin Leerdam or an Ahu Tolo or even a Brad Smith just trying to run back and track him without having to worry about possession in that situation. So I'm wondering, especially playing on turf on the road for a team that's been so poor on both, what is Dallas going to be able to do offensively? And I don't trust anything that Dallas is going to have defensively against a fully healthy. There's no key injuries in the attack, is there, for Seattle, Rachel?
No, everyone seems, knock on wood, to be healthy.
Okay. And then wasn't Brad Smith out for a little bit? Is he okay now?
Yeah, he's fine. I think the only worry for him is that he had to travel so far for international duty with Australia. So they're just kind of hoping that, you know, he comes back not too jet lagged.
Okay, so maybe Brad Smith, small question mark, jet lag, possibly. But other than that, that's not a big deal. So, I mean, I think unless Dallas really thought that they flipped a switch against Sporting Kansas City, or they catch Seattle on an off day, or, you know, maybe it's, you know, whatever happens with that center back situation, if Dallas is able to really exploit something bad going on there and then beat Stephen Fry. But I mean, goalkeeper matchup, Seattle absolutely wins this one. Seattle's great at home, Dallas is bad on the road, and I'm just not sure where this team goes from an offensive standpoint, and I'm not sure what they can do to stop the Seattle Sounders from a defensive standpoint. So I guess similar to the first playoff game that we looked at, Rachel, is there any doubt that Seattle doesn't get out of here with a win in 90 minutes?
No doubt.
Okay, and then let's move on to some of the later games. We'll start with the first night game that we have, I guess, depending on when the sun sets in Toronto. In any case, Toronto FC will be hosting DC United. This will be at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and this will also be on Fox Sports. This game is a little bit curious to me, Rachel, because, like, DC United, with everything that fell out, with Lucho completely checked out, and then Wayne Rooney mostly unavailable, like, went full Benny Ball in the last month of the season and, like, perfectly skidded in the playoffs, where, like, Ben Olsen is completely content being a wild card team, doesn't care about having to play on the road or anything. He's going to put numbers behind the ball and make it absolutely miserable for the opponent to do anything, and they're just going to really hope that something works, or that they're going to get to PKs, and then ultimately, you know, Bill Hamid, you know, they're not going to be able to hold him back or anything. And then on the other side, Toronto FC had a really poor middle bit of the season. They were still figuring things out and everything. We knew Pozuelo was good. We know the defense was figuring it out. Omar Gonzalez injects some life into that squad. As long as Josie was healthy, that they really just needed to get here. And then if they were clicking on all cylinders, they were still going to be a force to be reckoned with. And they're really the only team that has given New York City FC fits on the road at Yankee Stadium. So if there's any team that's well-equipped, again, when fully healthy, and we don't know what the status of Jozy Altidore is going into Saturday yet, that this was a team that was going to able to be a force in the Eastern Conference. They play well enough down the stretch and helped by DC United getting a 0-0 draw against a 9-man FC Cincinnati team in order to flip this seeding such that the game is at BMO Field but not at Audi Field. But I'm still really concerned about what Toronto's doing from an offensive standpoint if Josie's not available, because I feel like Ben Olsen is in his perfect element here, to where if Josie's not even in the 18, Rachel, that they're just going to be able to shut down Pozuelo, and like Paul Ariel is going to get one half chance to Quincy Ameriquois, and DC's going to get out of there with a 1-0 holding on to your butts result.
I think that this one has Toronto written all over it. I don't know why, but I think that, you know, when it comes to the playoffs, I don't think DC United is a team that I can really trust too much. I think that if Altidore is out, I think they do have some options to put in there. And I mean, you know, you never know with a guy like Michael Bradley. He's kind of everywhere on the pitch. And like, I feel like he scores when you least expect him to, but when you need him to. So, I mean, I don't know. Bradley magic might happen in Toronto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you that, like, I think it was Extra Time Radio on Monday. They were doing playoff previews and everything, and they were just asked about, like, what every single team needed to do. And I think Bobby Warshaw asked Matt Doyle, so, Doyle, what does Toronto FC need to do in order to advance past DC United on the weekend? And he said, score one goal. And so I absolutely, like, if DC's getting out of here, it's 0-0 and then a result in PKs, or it's maybe 1-0 in 120 minutes. And I feel like as soon as Toronto gets the first goal, as long as it's not, like, super fluky or an own goal or a PK out of nowhere or DC United doesn't get a red card, if it's anything indicative of how they're playing and their own quality and something they create of their own accord, then that is an indication that systematically the floodgates open. If they can get one, they can probably get two, and then they comfortably walk past, you know, a DC United team that is definitely under-talented relative to them. I just think that the one trigger that's going to be the easiest thing for them getting over that hurdle is having a healthy Jozy Altidore. And if Josie's not even in the 18, not even able to play a single minute for the team, then I think that opens the door to DC. And if Pozuelo's a little bit off, or if DC United comes and plays to the best of their Benny Ball abilities, then they will. Then that's a coin flip game, and it could absolutely go either way. And it's going to take a moment of brilliance, and that moment of brilliance could come from Paul Areola. It could come from Alejandro Pozuelo. It could come from Jonathan Osorio, who is fantastic against the United States for Canada. It could come from Michael Bradley. But I just think the Jozy Altidore situation and what's going on with his health and his fitness and ability to be available for selection or even just to start, even if it's just playing 60 minutes, is going to be so critical to this game. And I think that matters more than anything else DC United is going to be able to do to shut anybody else down. With that, let's do predictions on this one. I'll throw it to you first, Rach.
I think I'm going to go with Toronto here, but I think it's going to be one of those extra time games. But I think that somehow, some way, Michael Bradley is going to score. I really don't know how, but I really think he's going to do it.
Of course, that'd be a very trolly move for Bradley to do that, definitely. I'm going to put a contingency on this one. I think if Josie was able to play, I think Toronto rolls 2-0, maybe 3-0. And if Josie ends up not being able to play a part at all, then I think it's a coin flip game. I still think that Toronto is going to be able to win this game, though. So, you know, it'll either be, you know, it'll be like 1-0 or like 1-1 and then an extra goal in stoppage time, you know, with DC United just completely exhausted. But this could be a blowout if Josie's remotely healthy for this match. With that, let's move on to the final game that we have for Saturday. This will be Real Salt Lake hosting the Portland Timbers at 10 p.m. Eastern. And this will be on ESPN News of all things. Are you young enough, Rachel, to have seen Dodgeball and get the ESPN 8, the Ocho references?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, so in any case, this one is not ESPN the Ocho, but in any case, folks, I feel like this one is another slam dunk result in this one. Rachel, Diego Valeri reportedly injured. Obviously, he's been having, you know, the much reported on contract disputes and have had him unavailable or even on the bench for a couple of games. So who knows what his availability is. Brian Fernandez got a red card in the penultimate game of the weekend and then entered the voluntary substance abuse program available for players within the league. So definitely hoping he gets whatever is sorted out going on with him. But presumably, unless something changes in the next 48 hours, he's going to be unavailable. I'm not sure that I trust the Portland Timbers, given their state and how we've seen them play against good teams at home, go on the road, play at altitude, play on grass, where your best connection that you probably have for creating any offense is Sebastian Blanco to Jeremy Ibobasi, given how well RSL is playing at home. Like, I feel like this is an altitude slam dunk for RSL on Saturday night, if you ask me.
Well, and as a Sounders person, I can never pick Portland, so I think that Salt Lake is obviously my option here. I really want to see Nick Raimondo go out on a high note. I don't think RSL is going to be winning MLS Cup anytime soon unless they just want to like completely obliterate everything that Team Chaos has to provide for us and just go and rewrite the whole script. But I think Nick Raimondo has been strong this season. He's showing that age is just a number, and I think he'll hold it down, and I think RSL will somehow, some way get the win.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think we have anything else to say on this one. And then Portland's also been weak at the back, that second center back situation they've had. You know, I think if Portland does get a result in this one, it's got to, like, whatever spat has to be going out has to have ended. Villeri has to be back and has to be the best player on the field. And the team has to be stout enough defensively. That could be some great plays from Claude Dielna. That could be Diego Chará just absolutely bossing the game in the midfield. I definitely think that Steve Clark could make a couple of fantastic saves in this one. But all of those things kind of have to come together for Portland to get a result in this one, just given the circumstance that they're in, the players that they will be without, and there's no distinct weaknesses that I see that they're going to be able to exploit against RSL. I will say that RSL doesn't have an immediate game changer, like from a goal scoring standpoint. I don't think that Sam Johnson is that. I don't think that Albert Rusnak is that individually. You know, Demir Krylach was that last year in the one game playoff at LAFC that was able to get a result, but I think, you know, RSL has a much higher floor and I think definitely a lower ceiling than the Portland Timbers, but the Portland Timbers having that higher ceiling was based on things that were going on earlier in the season or with personnel that might not even be available in this game. And so a lot of dominoes have to fall in favor of Portland in order for that to be possible, where I feel like if RSL just shows up and plays their same solid game and doesn't make any critical mistakes, they're put in a really, really good situation in this one. I guess with that, Rachel, any other thoughts, or do we definitely agree that this is, again, you know, a home team comprehensive victory against the road team?
Well, it better be. We can't root for Portland over here.
Oh, well, this is a neutral podcast overall, Rachel. I understand your own personal allegiances that you may have. In any case, let us move on to the Sunday matches. And we will start with the game that I probably, other than Jozy Altidore's hamstring, probably have the least beat on of any of them. And that is the, I don't know if we're going to call this like the Cross New Jersey, just like Northeast hatred that isn't the Hudson River Derby. In any case, whatever you want to call it, folks, Philadelphia Union hosting the New York Red Bulls. This will be at 3 p.m. on FS1. The Philadelphia Union are back into the playoffs. This is the first time that they will be the higher seed in terms of hosting a home playoff game in a number of years with the Philadelphia Union under Jim Kirchen. What do you see in these two teams, Rachel, and what kind of a game could we get on Sunday between Philadelphia Union and the New York Red Bulls?
I think it's a question mark game. I think, you know, we're so used to New York Red Bulls being so dominant in the East, and this year they kind of had a roller coaster season and slipped into the playoffs. But I still think that, you know, they have those traces of dominance and, you know, could really make some noise. But Philadelphia is a strong team. They have a good defense. They have a really nice midfield with Alejandro Bedoya leading the way. But I don't know. I think this game is such a huge question mark. I really don't know what's going to happen. And I think if there's any game this entire weekend that could possibly end up in penalties, I think this one's it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just really curious about which team that we're actually going to see show up, especially given all the things that have gone wonky for the New York Red Bulls this year, just with trying to maintain their pressing style system, teams clearly having a beat for how to beat them and make them uncomfortable in that, and the team just not really having a key replacement for Tyler Adams, who left in the offseason, nor a clear and consistent goal scorer. You know, at times, Barlow and Brian Wright have been good. Bradley Wright Phillips has obviously fallen off a cliff. So, I mean, this is the one game maybe out of all of them that I don't see a clear, that neither team has a clear talisman that is going to be able to single-handedly win the game. If you told me right now, Rachel, that Wayne Rooney shows up and plays the best game that we've seen from him all year, I could absolutely see DC United getting a 2-0 win at Toronto FC. I absolutely think that they're individual game winners for both Atlanta and the New England Revolution. You know, I think that maybe the one exception is, you know, with RSL and Portland is if Diego Valeri shows up. And then other than that, I don't think that Portland has much of a player. I don't think that there's an individual, the rest of the team is playing crap. I'm going to have a singular moment to take over the game and completely decide the result and drag this team to a victory a la Robbie Keane with the LA Galaxy, a la Thierry Henry with the New York Red Bulls. You know, I would say to a lesser extent, maybe David Villa with New York City FC last year. I don't see a player like that on the Philadelphia Union. If it is, it might be Andre Blake, and we haven't seen that version of Andre Blake the entirety of 2019. I definitely don't see that player with the New York Red Bulls at this point. And obviously, Philly's won in a couple of different ways. So I think this game is entirely dependent on who has the clearer and the better game plan, and then who establishes their game plan and makes the opponent play that they want to play. If Philly has a clear plan to how to make the New York Red Bulls uncomfortable by not letting them press, then I think Philly's going to be successful, either if that plan is unsuccessful or if the Red Bulls are able to establish dominance in terms of pressing and execute that, then I think the New York Red Bulls win. But I'd say of all the games, this is the one that I have the least confidence in, because I'm not entirely sure which version from a Jekyll and Hyde standpoint is going to show up for either team, and I'm not sure that there's a singular match winner. And I mean, of all the playoff games that you're going to play, you know, Red Bulls fans travel well. It's a Saturday night game, so it's a Sunday game, so it's going to be pretty easy for people to get there. I don't see the same home field advantage that Philly might have had, you know, if they were playing, you know, Orlando City, for example, or FC Cincinnati, for example. And I just don't know which version of either team is going to show up. And in that, I think this is the biggest wild card of the first round for me.
I agree. I think, though, that somehow, some way, penalties... I would take Red Bulls.
I'd take Red Bulls too, just because I think in a matchup between 2019 Andre Blake and 2019 Luis Robles, I think Robles has the advantage on this one. I will say that I want to say it was actually against Philly. There was a point, not Curse of Curricolo, I think, and New York Red Bulls fans, if there's somebody listening, feel free to correct me on this, where that was a bit of a stickler for this team, not in MLS Cup playoffs, but Open Cup playoffs. And I think they won one of those, and it might have been against the Philadelphia Union, and that was like the exorcism of Open Cup PKs a couple of years ago for the New York Red Bulls. It might have been when they made the final against Kansas City that somewhere in that run they ended up winning in PKs in the Open Cup. So maybe that curse isn't there for the New York Red Bulls in this one. But I mean, this is the one game that I have the least certainty about, and in that it's probably getting me the most hashtag team chaos in this one. With that, Rachel, let's head to the final game of the first round and the final game of the weekend. This will be Minnesota United hosting LA Galaxy. This will be on Sunday at 8:30 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. An absolutely fantastic matchup between two teams. Lots on rolling in with the LA Galaxy. Minnesota United, I think, deservedly getting a home game for their newly christened Allianz Field. Rachel, what do you see in this match on Sunday night?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, good for Minnesota for having... just the drive to, you know, have these last two seasons not be what they wanted and then come in and just completely rewrite the script. Everybody had already counted them out and everything, you know, wink, wink, FC Cincinnati, take some notes here. But, I think that, you know, look good, feel good. And that stadium's gorgeous. They do well in it. And I think that Minnesota is going to hold down the fort. You know, I know the talk is around Zlatan, but I think that the Galaxy just don't have enough pieces when it comes to depth. If Zlatan can't really get the ball, then I don't really know what they're going to do. So I'm curious to see that. I'm curious to see how the midfields match up. But I think this one has to go to Minnesota. But I think it's going to be a tight game. I don't think it's going to be a blowout of any sorts. I think it's going to be a good, competitive, all-out 90-minute game.
Yeah, no, coming at this from an LA Galaxy standpoint, you know, I think this game warrants a lot of the concerns that probably, you know, you would say of the LA Galaxy all season. Yes, when Zlatan is on his game and absolutely engaged and absolutely cares, he is, you know, I'd say along with Carlos Vela and Jose Martinez, probably the most dangerous attacking player in MLS, and is able to single-handedly take over games, single-handedly get results in this one. When Zlatan's not feeling it, or he's frustrated, or he doesn't, or, you know, Sebastian Legette misses one pass, and Zlatan decides that he's going to sulk and brood and be angry and yell at other people and point for 10 minutes, then he's extremely unproductive. And kind of the one question that everybody had, just based on what was coming out of the LA Galaxy camp, I would say a lot of this was off of Zlatan's comments himself, Rachel, is that, you know, the system, like, MLS's setup is stupid because it doesn't really matter as long as you get to the playoffs. And this team's thought was, well, Zlatan cares about LAFC because of the rivalry and whatever, you know, sizing up war through the media that he has going on with Carlos Vela, that he cares about those individual games. But God forbid he has to care about a game against the lowly Houston Dynamo, who aren't even worthy of him getting his best game, even if that means that the team ends up losing because Zlatan doesn't show up and this team can't defend to save their own lives. So kind of the question everybody has now is, now that it's single elimination playoff games, and the whole approach last year was, as, yeah, we had a bad regular season, but as long as they make the playoffs, they're okay. And this is the exact same messaging that the team was getting all of this year. Now it's like, okay, they're into the playoffs, but you gave up a combined 8 goals in 2 games, in 2 losses to finish out against the lowly Vancouver Whitecaps and the lowly Houston Dynamo, especially given what you were able to do the 3 games prior to that. Those should have been 2 slam dunk wins, 2 slam, you know, slam dunk 6 points, and the team was going to be hosting a home playoff game. And now it's really, it'd have to be Dallas and Portland would both have to upset in the first round for the Galaxy to get a home playoff game in the Western Conference. And I think there's only three teams, I think, that could make it to MLS Cup from the East that the LA Galaxy would host against. And those are 3 teams that we've already said are, again, hopeless underdogs on the weekend. So there's a mentality concern, just given, like, okay, you talked a big game about as long as you get in the playoffs, you were going to be fine and you weren't going to care. Let's see you not care about having to play a road game against Minnesota United and actually go out there and get a result. And so I think Zlatan is capable of doing that. I think certainly we're going to see that from Christian Pavone, certainly from the midfield, like, Joe Corona and a Jonathan Dos Santos. But like you said, Rachel, I think the other concern you have for the LA Galaxy is just where they are from a defensive standpoint, because this team has rotated personnel in and out. They've rotated what position that they've played in, and it kind of doesn't seem to matter what system or what individuals they put in there, unless they are putting 10 men behind the ball and absolutely bunkering to save their lives, like we saw them do against LAFC in their 2 games, you know, especially in the entire second half of that game at Bank of California Stadium. This team isn't able to defend, and even when they do so, like, it's not pretty. This is a team that is consistently barely putting out fires and is not able to prevent them at all. So it's a little bit, it's kind of like that episode of SpongeBob, Rachel, where he falls asleep in the kitchen at the Krusty Krab, and like the Krusty Krab catches on fire and everything's on fire and he's just trying to blow it out. Or it's like the dog drinking the coffee at the kitchen table, and he's like, this is absolutely fine. And it's like, they're barely hanging on. Like, this is a team that is going to walk out of Allianz Field completely covered in soot and dirt, with their jerseys covered in grass stains and burn stains. And the final score is going to say LA Galaxy 4, Minnesota United 3. And they're going to be like, wow, that was an exciting ride. It was also terrible. Let's never do that again. And then they're going to have to go do that at least one more time at Bank of California Stadium, possibly at CenturyLink. And they're probably going to have to do that on the road for an MLS Cup if Zlatan wants to be able to win MLS Cup to prove once and for all that he's the greatest player to ever step foot in Major League Soccer. And so for those reasons, I think there's a lot of concern. And I don't think it matters what version of Minnesota United shows up, or what they do systematically against the LA Galaxy. Can the Galaxy show up and defense be attentive enough to put out the fires that are burning down their entire kitchen area enough such that Zlatan and Pavone, possibly a returning Roman Alessandrini off the bench, who's been in training the last couple weeks but has not been in the 18 for either of the last 2 games, even though GBS said that was a possibility. If all of those things happen, kind of similar to if Jozy Altidore is unavailable, then I think that game with DC United is a coin flip. If the Galaxy do that, then I think anything is possible. I think if anything less than happens in it, the Galaxy are potentially in trouble. I guess with that, Rachel, do you want to wager a score prediction for this final game?
Sorry, I'm going to disagree with you, and I'm going to go Minnesota 3, LA Galaxy 1.
All right, I'm going to say 4-3 to the LA Galaxy. This is going to be pure chaos. Like, this is going to be, like, there's going to be a Geiger show. It's going to be, the only way the Galaxy end up making it through this one is pulling a little finger and saying chaos is the ladder, and they're ultimately going to climb said ladder. Okay, listeners, that's it as far as our first round MLS Cup playoffs previews we've done. We've previewed every single game. Rachel and I have given our predictions from a results standpoint. Rachel, why don't you close out the show for us with some pick'ems, NWSL playoff pick'ems previews.
Yeah, well, before I get to the pick'ems, I know last week we were talking about the Laura Harvey, Vlatko Andonovsky. So in a pick'em in a sort of way, I think it looks like Vlatko is going to be picked to be the next U.S. Women's National Team head coach. Laura Harvey had said after Utah ended their regular season this last weekend, I'm not going to be the U.S. National Team head coach. I don't know who's going to be, but all signs are pointing to Vlatko. So we will see about that. Speaking of Vlatko Andonovsky, we have his side, Reign FC, taking on the North Carolina Courage. You have seed number one taking on seed four. And the Courage have such a really big advantage here. They're at home. This is their second week in a row that they're at home. And if they win, they are at the final at their home stadium at Wake Med Soccer Park. You know, really would love to see Reign win because of all of the stuff they've had to go through this season. Vlatko Andonovsky really coaching his team and getting depth, literally pulling at corners and trying to get something out of the tablecloth. But I think that North Carolina, just at home, they're so dangerous and that team is so good just together. They have the perfect balance of internationals and domestic players that I think that they're going to pull it off. But I don't think Reign's going to make it easy on them. I think it's going to be 2-1. And then the later match on Sunday is Chicago Red Stars versus Portland Thorns. I think that when Chicago is in the playoffs, they kind of just kaput. They don't really know what's going on, and they normally always lose. They've never made it to a final yet. But I think that this year is going to be different. I think this is the year of Sam Kerr. She broke her own NWSL scoring record, has 18 goals. And I think she's been extremely motivated by there's talks of her possibly going to Europe. There's talks of her never winning a championship, you know, whether it's here or back in her native Australia. And she had a not a disappointing World Cup, but just for Australia in general, it was disappointing to crash out so early in the knockout rounds to Norway on penalties. But I think Chicago wins 3-1. I think we're going to get a brace from Kerr and possibly another goal from Yuki Nagasato, who is just showing that age, just like Nick Raimondo, is just a number. And she has just been absolutely fantastic this year for Chicago. So I think we'll see North Carolina and Chicago in the final.
I agree with you, Rachel. I think we're going to see the two home teams in this one. You know, I got a little bit of a preview. For those of you who don't listen to it, I would encourage you to go check out this week's iteration of the BBC World Football podcast, of which Heather O'Reilly, North Carolina Courage player, is a semi-regular co-host now, and Manny Jasmine, who works for the BBC, asked her about the game and how the NWSL playoff structure looks like and what it would be like, you know, playing against Reign FC, and of course Heather O'Reilly's former national team teammate in Pino. But I agree with you, Rachel. I think North Carolina is just really, really good at home, and obviously they're talented. You know, just obviously is, you know, back-to-back defending NWSL champions. And I'll take Chicago in this one. You know, Portland Thorns didn't really look too good at home, and I'm just kind of wondering, you know, maybe they're doing the opposite of peaking at the right time, or maybe they just kind of hit a little bit of a skid right before the playoffs. So I'll take the two home teams in this one, but I won't give a score line. That does it for us as far as all of the big stuff that we had planned for tonight. It is time for last words. Rachel, are there any last burning things that you can't let go, and where can people find you on the Twitter machine?
I think that right now we're at a great time for women's soccer in the country. I know I said it last year, but I think that all eyes should be tuned in this weekend on both MLS playoffs and NWSL playoffs, because there's some really good competition, really great players. It's not just your national team players. You've got great rookies out there. You've got great goalkeepers. And I think it's just going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a great weekend of action. And you know, with these four teams, you never know what's going to happen. So I will be covering the action all weekend at Rachel McCrigger. I will be in North Carolina next weekend bringing a ton of content from Media Day, the actual championship and whatnot to all of you viewers. And you can also check that out on our at Last Word SC. I will be sure to get some videos and such up there as well.
Well said, Rachel. No last words for me. Follow me individually on Twitter, listeners, at LWS Matt Pollard. Check us out at lastwordonsoccer.com for all of our coverage, NWSL or MLS Cup, playoff related or otherwise. At Last Word SC across all social media platforms. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe you're listening to us through your favorite podcatcher right now. Just search LWS Radio or Last Word on Sports, and you'll find us in a bunch of other great stuff that our affiliates at Last Word on Soccer, Last Word on Sports Incorporated, put together. With that, thank you to our sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of MLS, USL, and US Soccer. Get your custom scarves for your group or team at roughneckscarves.com. Listeners, we'll see you next week, recapping all the playoff action, men's and women's, from the weekend. We'll see you then.